I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. What are the prospects for better mental health services under the Affordable Care Act? We asked Baltimore psychiatrist Mark Comrade for his assessment today. Will health insurance expansion through Medicaid and the private marketplace improve access and raise the level of care? Will we finally close some of the gaps in a convoluted and expensive system that left too many people with untreated conditions? We'll hear from Dr. Comrade about that and about two related stories, that of the young man who carried out the Columbia Mall shooting in January and the recent New Yorker article about Sandy Hook mass killer Adam Lanza. Dr. Mark Comrade joins us on Midday after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here on WYPR, WYPF, WYPO, and streaming live through WYPR.org. However you're listening to the show, we certainly appreciate you listening and tuning in to Midday, making it part of your day. 2 weeks ago, The New Yorker published an article profiling Peter Lanza, father of Adam Lanza, who in December 2012 in Connecticut committed one of the most horrific and baffling mass murders in U.S. history. The article's author, Andrew Solomon, spent 6 months in conversations with Peter Lanza, and his profile, for one thing, managed to dismantle the previously held perception of Adam Lanza's father as a distant and uncommitted man, uncommitted parent. The article is an in-depth account of caring parents who continually struggled to understand a difficult and clearly troubled child. Today on Midday, we discuss the New Yorker story with Dr. Mark Comrade, psychiatrist and a contributor to Midday. He'll be with us in this hour of the show. We'll get to that a little bit later on. We'll also discuss some recently revealed facts about Darian Marcus Aguilar, the 19-year-old who in January opened fire at the mall in Columbia, killing two before turning the gun on himself. Police reports in Howard County have revealed that Aguilar admitted to hearing voices, looked into getting some help, but never actually did. Up front, though, we start today's conversation with a look at the Affordable Care Act and how mental health is covered under the law and whether the expansion of health insurance in the United States will mean more access to people for mental health services. So we bring Dr. Comrade into the conversation. Mark Comrade is a psychiatrist on the clinical and teaching staffs of the Shepherd Pratt Hospital and the Johns Hopkins Hospital. Dr. Comrade, nice to have you back on the show, Mark.
Thanks so much. Great to be back.
Obamacare. Obamacare attempts to expand health insurance coverage to more Americans, many who didn't have it, many who were underinsured, didn't have very good plans, and hopefully that's going to be happening here, and it is happening. In terms of mental health services, access to services, and the expense of services, how do you see it?
I see the Obamacare, the provisions of the Obamacare with regard to mental health, to be the thing I have been waiting for my entire career, something I hoped would occur before I retire or even die. And I am just, I feel like, you know, I'm in a dream. It truly is, for the mental health professions, potentially the Dream Act. And let me explain why. Really, we have to go all the way back to the 1960s, when the insurance industry really came alive and was born. And it was really around that time that mental health treatment first began to be covered by insurance, initially by Medicare. And for a variety of historical reasons, rather than having coverage like for medical conditions or surgical conditions, Medicare instituted a curious difference for mental health treatment. It covered only 50% of the usual fees, both doctor's fees and hospital fees, rather than the usual 80% that it would cover for everything else. Well, you know, once Medicare is the 900-pound gorilla in the nation, and once Medicare speaks, everybody else follows, and the private insurance industry followed and basically implemented that rule of 50% coverage. Then, a couple of decades later, along comes managed care. And managed care began to crack down on the ability to use your insurance, even at that 50% level, by having incredibly stringent requirements on what they would cover, how many sessions, how many days in the hospital. So what happened is the money began to drain out of mental health treatment drastically, to the point that it was no longer, number one, profitable to have inpatient beds in your hospital devoted to psychiatry. And we ended up having a 90% loss of psychiatric beds since the 1950s as a result of that. Similarly, it became increasingly difficult for mental health professionals to make a living by taking insurance. So as a result, a recent survey has shown that whereas 89% of other physicians participate in insurance plans, only 55% of psychiatrists and other mental health professionals participate in insurance plans.
So let me stop you there. What's the reason for that? Is managed care the villain in that history?
Well, I think it's a number of factors. Managed care was a very, very big turning point in terms of, because what happened is that prior to the managed care era, 8% of every healthcare dollar was spent on mental health treatment. In the post-managed care, or the current climate, only 2% of every healthcare dollar is spent on mental health care. So,
can you unravel that a little bit for me, just before we go on? Why is that? Because of attitudes about mental health, the suspicion that it's the worried well and not people who aren't really suffering from a clinical disorder?
Well, I think there's some of that. I think some of that also are certain inefficiencies in the use of the healthcare dollar in the mental health care system. I think some of that is due to the fact that many mental health conditions are chronic conditions, chronic long-term lifetime conditions. So it's not like having the flu or pneumonia or a flare-up of arthritis that then, you know, settles down and you don't see the doctor for another couple of years. The fact is that good quality mental health care treatment is a very intensive service, both as an outpatient as well as inpatient and partial hospitalizations. So as a result of all this, we have both the practical loss of resources for treating mental health and these differences between mental health care and other kinds of medical care also contributed. It may have been the product of stigma, but also contributed to the idea that this is different. So with all this background, in 2008, Congress bravely attempted to pass a law that tried to correct these inequities, and that law was called the Mental Health Parity and Addictions Equity Act, and was passed into law sponsored by Patrick Kennedy, who's still one of the great champions of mental health treatment.
Just read an op-ed that he wrote about this, about parity.
And Rosalynn Carter has been involved in this effort for many, many years.
Now, when they say parity, they're talking about parity between...
So, namely, to treat mental health conditions with regard to insurance without distinction from other health care conditions.
Okay.
Turned out that law had a lot of loopholes. So many loopholes, it was practically dead on arrival. For example, one of the most significant loopholes was that if you get your insurance through an employer that has less than 50 employees, that law doesn't apply. And there are other numerous exceptions to the rule. So when they were crafting the Affordable Health Care Act, affectionately known as Obamacare, they utilized that 2008 law as the template on which they built, and they strengthened that law and installed it
in
Affordable Care Act, in some really, truly remarkable ways. So first of all, it closes the loophole that these parity provisions now apply to everybody. It applies to big employers, small employers, individual policies, and so forth. Secondly, here's another interesting thing historically. It was quite legal and quite common, unfortunately, for health insurance to exclude psychiatric care as a covered benefit. There are certain things your insurance might not cover, and one of those could be and often was mental health care. So, you know, it's a very curious thing. So not only would it exclude seeing a psychiatrist or psychologist or social worker or being hospitalized on an inpatient psychiatric unit if that was necessary, but it would also even exclude covering medications that were considered psychiatric medications. So it would cover your Lipitor, but it wouldn't cover your Prozac.
Mm-hmm.
It's because psych treatment was not covered. So
Obamacare took care of that. Okay.
It is now one of the mandatory benefits that mental health treatment, all the both outpatient treatment, inpatient treatment, the medications that are given, are one of the so-called essential benefits. It's right there with ER visits and maternity, well, baby care and labs and pediatrics. And the interesting thing is that, very importantly, it's not just psychiatric meds or doctor visits or hospital visits that are covered with the same rules. We'll talk about that in a second. But psychotherapy, talk therapy, is now considered an essential benefit as well.
Someone listening to your description of this now may say, in their own experience, in their own family, or just their own experience, will say, wow, this really is a change from what I'm used to in the past. In the past, I'm used to paying out of pocket almost completely for my coverage because insurance didn't cover those things. And now there's an opportunity here to get coverage for, maybe a chronic condition that's existed in a family for a long time.
Right. And, I mean, it actually gets better than that. It turns out that even those insurances that used to cover some mental health treatment, there were certain aspects that it wouldn't cover, such as so-called rehabilitation care.
Hmm.
And again, under the parity provision, mental health treatment is, in theory, we'll talk about this theory versus practice in a second, but in theory, it's supposed to be identical, indistinguishable from medical surgical treatment. So if your plan allows you to go to a rehab center after your knee surgery to get orthopedic rehabilitation, then your plan must allow you to go to a psychiatric rehabilitation program. That's also incredibly revolutionary. Used to be that only Medicaid would pay for psych rehab programs. The criteria for reviewing whether or not treatment is necessary, you know, pre-authorization, you know, that word that makes everybody tremble, has to be identical kinds of criteria to what your diabetes care, your arthritis care gets pre-authorized. And the formula, and here is something that we have yet to see whether it's going to work and how it's going to work. And there are a number of authorities in the field keeping a close eye on trying to hold insurance companies' feet to the fire. But rates, the way in which the usual and customary fees are determined need to be identical to the kinds of formulas that are used for, you know, your knee problem or for your emphysema.
So parity.
So parity, meaning the same. The same.
How did we make all this progress, Dr. Conrad? I mean, it sounds great. I have a lot of questions for you with regard to it, but it sounds like with the Affordable Care Act, those politicians in Washington, were lobbied to break through some old or break apart, break down, dismantle some old attitudes about mental health.
Well,
coverage.
It wasn't easy. It still is not easy. You know, there's still tremendous political wrangling about all of this. I think that. You know, what causes a tipping point in social change is always an interesting question. The interesting thing, though, is that this whole system was crafted before some of the more recent horrors that we've seen in the news. So I don't think that it's, for example, we've recently had the anniversary of Newtown. We're going to talk about that later. I don't think it was really that. There is a growing sense, at least in this particular administration, of social justice. Indeed, we hear that this is a topic of a conversation between Obama and the Pope, who seem to be on the same wavelength about this, is probably relevant. There are other provisions of Obamacare that are not unique to mental health treatment, but mental health treatment benefits tremendously from, for example, pre-existing conditions. The fact that you cannot be excluded for insurance or have to pay more because you already have a condition is a tremendous benefit because a lot of people, since mental illness conditions often are chronic, have been around a long time, they would often exclude people from getting insurance. Another great thing that's not unique to mental health care but is present but benefits from it is the idea that children can be on their parents' insurance until age 26. Why is that important? Because it turns out that probably about 75 or 80% of all mental health problems are already up and running before age 26. So the fact is it used to be in the old days, right around the time that many conditions such as major depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia would begin, oftentimes after age 18, even after age 21, in that range, 21 to 26, and lo and behold, kids were dropped from the parents' insurance. You couldn't get them on. So the fact that they can stay on a parents' insurance is now a tremendous boon for mental health treatment.
We're going to take a break here. I have a number of questions for Dr. Conrad about the Affordable Care Act and mental health services. If you do too, please call us. This is a good time to call Midday and ask Dr. Conrad a question about the Affordable Care Act, 410-662-8780, or write it by email. Send in your question by email, midday@wypr.org. Our toll-free long-distance number is 866-661-9309, right? Almost forgot it again. Anyway, well, short break. We'll come back with Dr. Conrad. Dr. Mark Conrad joining us again. Dr. Conrad's book, You Need Help, A Step-by-Step Plan to Convince a Loved One to Get Counseling. A little bit later on in the show, we'll be talking to Dr. Conrad, getting his reaction to the recent New Yorker profile of Peter Lanza, the father of the Sandy Hook mass killer, Adam Lanza, and also to what we found out about the shooter in the Columbia Mall shooting in January and out in Howard County. We'll be talking to Dr. Conrad about that in a few minutes. But first, back to the Affordable Care Act and what it means for mental health services in the United States. You sound mostly optimistic about this. You like what you're seeing in this law, especially that word parity and what that brings to it. I want to go back to rates for a minute. Would you just go over that for us again? What does it do with regard to rates that insurance companies or the doctors can charge for mental health services?
The formulas for the calculation of rates have got to really be identical to the way in which rates are calculated for surgeons and internists and general medicine.
Okay.
And those formulas are complicated. And by the way, one of the things that the law calls for is that there must be total transparency in publishing what those formulas are.
Okay.
So, because heretofore they've been cryptic and proprietary, and nobody's entirely sure about them.
Dr. Conrad, you mentioned earlier that the number of psychiatric professionals who participate in insurance is lower than it is, much lower than it is for general doctors, right? So what does this do to address that? I mean, what's going to make more psychiatrists buy into this?
Yeah, I think that parity will attract the psychiatrists back if indeed it works. And, you know, again, the proof is in the pudding. But if it works, these formula for parity ought to be able to restore psychiatric treatment to a more equitable level in terms of, first of all, you know, not having to fight for every three or four visits, not having to fight, you know, one day at a time. You know, in psychiatry, unlike other fields of medicine, when you have someone in the hospital, you get a call, at least heretofore, you would get a call from a reviewer every single day saying, why do they have to be here another day? Why today? Mm-hmm. Are they still suicidal today? Oh, they're feeling better today. Okay, well, that'll be the end of that. And, you know, please go ahead and arrange for their discharge. Or, of course, you're welcome to keep them, but we're not going to pay anymore. So there'll be so that has been very, very daunting and discouraging to institutions as well as doctors. And then the idea that the pay scale may actually be more equitable. As I pointed out, you know, we've gone from 8% of the healthcare dollar to 2% of the healthcare dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And these formula may indeed begin, it turns out, you know, a half an hour that a psychiatrist spends with a patient is reimbursed at a much, much lower rate before now than a half an hour than an internist spends with a patient. Even though both of them may spend most of the time talking, maybe one of them is doing laying out of hands more than the other. And the other thing is that now there's a whole new coding system, and this is actually something separate from Obamacare, that allows and encourages psychiatrists to use the same codes, the so-called evaluation and management codes, E&M codes, that your dermatologist and cardiologist use. And Obamacare is supposed to ensure that when we bill a code like 99214, that the insurance will cover 99214 at the same level that they would if we were a dermatologist.
Again, back to parity. So that we have the large umbrella principle of parity here at play in mental health services under the Affordable Care Act and the expansion of health insurance. And it seems like it addresses two of the big problems in mental health services, accessibility and expense.
Right.
It addresses those two things. But my question is, if doctors will buy in, are there going to be enough doctors? This is a question. If we have a rush of people who have been putting off delaying seeing a doctor with one of these conditions, are there enough psychiatrists around to handle this?
So this is the work manpower, womanpower issue, which is very significant. Now, in some of the specialties that are not the high-paying specialties, like psychiatry, like primary care and pediatrics, there is a difficulty recruiting people to join those specialties. Part of the reason is that the cost of going to medical school, you know, by the time that you're done with college loans and then med school loans, is $500,000. And that's a big debt load to carry.
So let's talk about that for a second. Mm-hmm. So medical students that you might be seeing today,
yes,
right, they're not going into this specialty in the numbers that is needed to sustain the system?
Well, between the reimbursement levels that have to work on paying back loans, as well as the incredible discouraging hoops that psychiatrists have to jump through that seem to be particularly onerous, and hopefully some of those will at least have parity and not be so extreme for us.
Give us an example. What do you mean by that?
Well, for example, as I said before, we may have to, it used to be that if you want to see your internist would not have to get the number of visits approved if you wanted to come in for diabetes for the next year. We used to have to get visits shelled out in aliquots of five or six or seven visits.
So the doctor
and then go back and write up another plan to justify why we need another five or seven visits.
So that's a bureaucratic hassle. Plus, the doctor doesn't know for sure how many visits he's going to get with the patient.
That's right, and how it's going to go.
Now this addresses that then.
Right. Okay. So all of these kinds of things, as well as the finances, have been discouraging students. We already, you know, some areas where we have adequate manpower, but even here in Maryland, there are counties that are very significantly understaffed. It's very difficult to get a psychiatrist to come and see patients. And this is true nationwide, and it's predicted that by 2021, we're probably going to be at about a 60% manpower level. In other words, 40% short of the psychiatrists that we need in this nation.
Here, let me cite something for you along these lines from the Association of American Medical Colleges. The number of licensed psychiatrists dropped slightly between 2005 and 2010, while the general population of the United States grew nearly 5%. An alarming 57% of psychiatrists are over the age of 55, with retirement on the horizon at 55. And again, the same source I'm citing there, that's their word, alarming. I would say that does sound troubling if 57% of psychiatrists over the age of 55. Yeah.
An interesting statistic is we tend to retire later than most physicians.
Is that right?
Thank goodness, you know, little compensation really there, yes.
But I'm wondering, what about it, besides the expense and the payoff for all those medical school bills, what else may be discouraging? You mentioned the bureaucracy as well, the hoops.
Well,
what about the practice itself?
The practice itself,
the practice has changed a lot, isn't it?
It's changed a lot. And also, the fact is that we have, we operate from a variety of different constructs and perspectives in psychiatry. We're not just treating an organ with its damaged cells, with very well-defined pathophysiology and a very deep understanding of the exact mechanism of actions of what we do. We certainly do deal with the brain. We also deal with the mind. We deal with social context. We deal with the world of meaning and people's life stories. We deal with issues that impact mental health, like poverty and work, family and relationships. These are a very, very challenging and complex work, very satisfying work, but something that has a much, much greater breadth and much wider skill set than, say, trying to help somebody's heart beat more efficiently.
Right.
So as a result, it tends to not necessarily attract your average med student.
I get that. It also, maybe the use of pharmaceuticals. You talk about that a little bit. I mean, psychiatry has changed from that, that image we have of the psychiatrist with notepad sitting by a couch listening to a patient describe their problems to, shorter sessions and prescription of medication, right? And so that may not be as, and I don't want to say sexy or as appealing to a medical student. Right?
It may be more appealing to some than it used to be and less to others. For those that were interested in going to psychiatry to have the complete, to be the complete psychiatrist, I fancy myself the complete psychiatrist because I do both therapy and medications, sort of one-stop shopping, at least for the majority of my patients. It is discouraging when all of the manpower shortages and the market forces are pushing psychiatrists out of doing talk therapy. Mm. I mean, there was that infamous front page article in the New York Times last year about the psychiatrist who, the weary psychiatrist who was slogging his way through 45 patients a day. And as soon as one patient would want to talk about, their job or their marriage or something like that, he'd put up his hand and say, stop right there.
Right.
So, we can't talk further. Why? Because it was very difficult because he did take insurance. And it was very, very difficult for him to make a living seeing one patient an hour.
I remember that.
One can also argue, aside from the finances, there is a certain sensibility if you only have a limited supply of psychiatrists and psychiatrists are the only mental health professionals who can prescribe medication, you can understand why there may be certain manpower incentives to use the psychiatrist to do that and use other mental health professionals, psychologists and social workers to spend the hour talking.
You're listening to Midday on WYPR. Dan Roderick's here today with Dr. Mark Comrade, author of You Need Help, A Step-by-Step Plan to Convince a Loved One to Get Counseling. Dr. Comrade is a psychiatrist on the clinical and teaching staffs of the Shepherd Pratt Hospital and Johns Hopkins Hospital. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. If you'd like to join us in a conversation, if you have a question for Dr. Comrade or an answer to my question, because of your insurance situation over the years, have you put off seeing a psychiatrist or someone in your family has been unable to avail themselves of services that you thought were needed merely because it seemed like such a financial hurdle to pay completely out of pocket to see a psychiatrist? Or the whole idea of going to a psychiatrist just seemed expensive and not accessible to you. Is your mind changing now? Have you learned more about the Affordable Care Act? Will it make mental health services actually available to you? And we'd like to hear from you about that. 410-662-8780. You mentioned lack of psychiatrists in rural areas.
Right.
That remains a problem. From what I read, they tend to be in more urban areas.
Yes, that's
so
right.
I don't know how Obamacare will affect that.
Well, one of the things that parity calls for is parity says that if you're going to write insurance, you must have a certain number of doctors on your panel.
The insurance company.
Insurance company must. That participate in your insurance. If you don't have that, you're not licensed, you're not accredited to write insurance. So, and that used to actually not include psychiatrists. Now it has to include psychiatrists. So this remains to be determined as to whether or not insurance plans are actually going to be able to do the business they need to do by trying to make appropriate incentives to make sure psychiatrists sign up so that they can fulfill those parity requirements.
How will that help in terms of the question I raised about rural areas and accessibility?
Right. So the fact of the matter is if you are, in a plan that covers rural areas, you have to be able to demonstrate that the plan has to be able to demonstrate to you that they have psychiatrists. And
deliver.
Not just the number of doctors that they have that they can deliver, but also what's the waiting period? So you have to be careful about that because maybe they would say we have a lot of docs. And by the way, a lot of these lists are not up to date, which is problematic. But sure, we got plenty of docs, but how long does it take to get an appointment? Because of these shortages, it could be a couple of months before you can get an appointment. So there are also parity requirements about waiting periods as well. And insurance companies are going to have to pony up and make it attractive for doctors to say, sure, sign me up. So there's going to be a lot of pressure coming from parity. But again, only if it's enforced, which brings us to the enforcement question.
Oh, who does oversee all this to see that it's happening?
Right.
In Maryland, is the insurance commissioner in Maryland?
There are a number of authorities keeping track. Absolutely. The Maryland Insurance Commission is definitely somebody that's watching and that these kind of inequities need to be reported to. The American Psychiatric Association has now set up a whole function for being able to monitor and report to them inequities that really violate parities. And in fact, there's a toll-free number for that, 866-882-6227.
Now what is that number?
That's
again?
That's the American Psychiatric Association.
To report
any concerns that you may have that your insurance company is not following the parity rules, or you can write to hsf@psych.org.
Okay.
There's also a commission called the Utilization Review Accreditation Commission, URAC.com, that's an oversight body that licenses managed care companies. And they have a whole report in URAC.com where you can go and report inequities
and
get
oversight.
People delicensed if necessary.
Okay. So you think there's enough oversight for and enforcement for compliance and all?
We'll see.
we're going to take another break here, Dr. Comrade. We'll come back. We'll take some calls for you. But also I want to talk about the article in the New Yorker by Andrew Solomon, based on his extensive interviews with the father of Adam Lanza. If you had a chance to read that article, please stay tuned. You'll hear what Dr. Comrade has to say about it. 410-662-8780 is our number. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Again, our number, 410-662-8780. Susan in Baltimore has a question for Dr. Comrade. Susan, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Go right.
If I'm on Medicaid, how much mental health coverage will I qualify for in a year?
She's been put on Medicaid. That was her.
Yeah, I can't tell you that specifically or how to quantify that. But let me just say that Medicaid in Maryland has actually always had a fair policy for covering medications, for covering hospital, for even covering rehabilitation care, which is, as I said before, is the only thing that heretofore prior to the ACA has covered rehabilitation care. The rates that Medicaid or medical assistance in Maryland pays have heretofore been pretty low. It's been pretty low. Here's the interesting thing is that as of today, the parity laws do not apply yet to Medicaid, but they are expected to do so within the next few months. The government hasn't come out and ruled on that yet, but there's no reason to think
that they would be excluded.
That they would be
exempted.
Yeah. The good news, again, for mental health, because Medicaid already has some significant mental health benefits, is the Medicaid expansion part of the ACA. And Maryland is one of the states that has wisely chosen to participate in that so that a lot more people who have limited income will now be available for Medicaid. And by the way, the way in which you qualify for Medicaid has completely changed. No longer will it be based on what your assets are. They're now going to be based on what your income is. You won't have to spend yourself down to poverty to get onto Medicaid.
That's been the biggest front of expansion in Maryland is Medicaid. I think the number I saw last week was 193,000 new people signed up, but maybe past 200,000 now.
Right.
Here's an email for you, Dr. Comrade. This is from Marlene, who is a social worker, a mental health professional. I'm very interested in how to tackle the issue of reducing, eliminating stigma. I have an idea that perhaps there should be money devoted to public service messages that would play on TV just like car, beer, and cereal commercials that address stigma and promote people getting help. For example, a little drama on TV where someone is talking about their symptoms of depression and then displaying a number to call for help. Maybe there should be billboards around devoted to this idea.
Well, of course, a number of nonprofits do that, one of which I'm on the board of, the Maryland Foundation for Psychiatry. We run all sorts of public service announcements. We have a very, very cute thing for college students to deal with stigma. It's called lovefromdepression.com. And it's a website with a couple of really interesting and cute videos about how depression moves into a college room as your roommate and begins to take over your life. That's an example of just the kind of campaign that I think Marlene is talking about.
Or on a national level, really. I mean, what you're talking about today is very important. I'm glad you're doing this and coming in here. But, you know, the people who are running healthcare.gov, Obamacare, the federal government, Kathleen Sebelius.
SAMHSA.
Should all be out there in front saying, this is included too, folks.
By the way, one of the great moments of my career is I sat literally 15 feet away from Kathryn Sebelius when she announced, today is the day that parity begins. I was down at the Carter Center with Mrs. Carter, who generously—
Rosalind Carter.
Rosalind Carter, who wrote the foreword to my book. So I was down there with her, and, you know, she's been very involved, and Secretary Sebelius made the big announcement, and I was right there, and it was a great moment.
She used the P word.
She used the P word, exactly. It was one of the great moments in my own career.
Mark, back to the phone lines for Maya in Baltimore. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you so much for this program. This program has really been great. I've got a son who's away at college, and he has terrible anxieties plus other mental health issues, and he was begging me to see a doctor for winter break, and I had to call 25 doctors, and nobody could see him, A, because they didn't take insurance, and it would have been $175 out of pocket, or B, they were just too busy, so my other option was just to take him to a hospital. But I begged my internist to please see him because I was desperate.
And I hope your internist was able to be helpful to you. Turns out that 6 out of every 7 people who get mental health treatment actually get it from their primary care doc, not from a psychiatrist, because most cases, you know, that can be handled. It's only the 1 out of 7 that can't. Going to a hospital or hospital center is sometimes a good alternative because they maintain, you know, a rich database and often of staff members that are available. I know, for example, Shepherd Pratt has that. If you call, they'll hook you up with somebody, and they even have a walk-in clinic now at Shepherd, so you don't have to go to an ER. You can actually walk in, and they'll have one of the psychiatrists on duty that day see you, you know, before the day is over.
Speaking of this, there's something in the story that came out of Columbia a couple of weeks ago regarding the shooting Columbia, the mall in Columbia, that I wanted to talk to you about, with what the police disclosed that they had learned about the shooter who killed 2 people in the mall and then himself in January, a 19-year-old shooter. This is what I'm just going to read a little bit here from the Baltimore Sun's account of the police press conference. And Dr. Comrade, I'd like to get some of your thoughts on this. Months before he entered the mall with a Mossberg 500 series pump action shotgun and explosives, Darian Marcus Aguilar had disclosed to a general practitioner that he was hearing voices. This is according to the chief of police. The doctor told police that he urged the young man to follow up with a psychiatrist, but investigators have no evidence that he did. While the doctor told detectives that he told the shooter's mother about the mental illness symptoms, Aguilar's mother maintained she never received the information, and police have no evidence corroborating the doctor's story. One last thing here. Police believe Aguilar began researching mass shootings and violent topics in January 2013. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he was also researching websites on mental illness, including a suicide help website, but there's no indication if he ever asked for help. In a journal, he wrote that he was reluctant to tell his mother about his health issues.
Mm-hmm. This is a very, very sad backstory to this story. I'm very interested in the fact that primary care doc was involved. In my book, You Need Help, it's one of the techniques that I talk about is if it's necessary, if direct communication isn't going well, to work through a person's primary care doc, because very often, as I told the last caller, that primary care doc can actually implement treatment him or herself, or at least broker referral. Of course, in this case, I think the lesson from this particular story is the importance of follow through and follow up. Now, the interesting thing is that government just ruled on to clarify a certain HIPAA issue. And the clarification was that there may be some circumstances when dealing with psychiatric disorders in which it is appropriate, even dutiful and virtuous, for the physician to reach out to other family members and caretaking people in a person's life in order to connect with them about the patient's condition or the patient's treatment, the patient's regimen. That clarification, which, by the way, we've known about, but HIPAA has finally made clear,
which means
would
it
have
would
helped
not,
here.
It would not be considered an invasion of privacy.
Right, for the doc to say, right. You know,
or confidence.
Let's have your mom in,
right.
You know, or give the mom a call saying, I really think,
wow.
You know, he needs
that
to.
That seems significant.
Yes,
to
he needs to see a psychiatrist.
Did you
absolutely.
Regard that as significant?
Absolutely, so that you can have that kind of follow through. But, you know, at the very least, you know, giving the patient a call or having the nurse give the patient a call to try to follow through. And to make even better is, you know, to actually call up the psychiatrist colleague and say, you know, I got somebody in my office, you know, can you see him? When's the appointment? Let me know whether he showed up or not. I think that this is the learned lesson from that misadventure.
I also drew to your attention, Dr. Comrade, Andrew Solomon's piece about Peter Lanza, the father of Adam Lanza, who carried out the mass killing in Newtown, Connecticut, at the Sandy Hook Elementary School, December 2012. I mean, a fascinating read in The New Yorker, not surprising given the author, Andrew Solomon. But I wanted to get your impressions of what you read there, what you took away from his profile of Peter Lanza in the life of Adam Lanza, his father and mother.
Well, this is a long-awaited article, I think, by many of us. Painful article to read. As I think I shared with you, you know, it produced as much anxiety in me as it does illumination. Anxiety both as a psychiatrist to just be reminded of the limitations of our powers and also as a parent as well. But there are a few specific things that I took away from this article, and I think there's some take-home points. Number one is that even if somebody is brought to a psychiatrist, as it appears Adam Lanza was, first of all, a psychiatrist, we cannot reliably predict violence. We're pretty good at saying who's not. We're right most of the time when we say who's not going to be violent, because most people aren't. But we're not very good at predicting who is going to be violent. Secondly, even if a person comes to see us, as it turns out, Adam Lanza was in some psychiatric care, that patients do not necessarily stay. And families often feel helpless about how to keep their family member in treatment, as was the case with Nancy Lanza here. It's one of the things that I address in my book is how families can perhaps more effectively tap their own power to be able to get people into and keep them in treatment. Another point of this article demonstrates that the family members of these mass shooters are as much victims as others, whether they're literally killed, as in the case of Nancy, or the tremendous, devastating psychological trauma on his father. And I think that that brings is brought out very poignantly.
Let me ask you, what did you think of Solomon's account of Nancy Lanza's relationship to Adam, yeah. Especially in the last 2 years?
Well, you know,
where she seemed to be protecting him, yeah. And not actually wanting to disturb him or upset
yes.
him, right?
Right. And, you know, sometimes the most effective intervention that can be made for somebody who's living in a family with mental illness, especially if they're not willing to participate in treatment, is to actually get the parents into some kind of psychological counseling and help handholding and brainstorming and advising. In fact, I treat a number of people where I'm treating the family members of the person with the serious mental illness to try to make this happen. And because one of the things that happens, it's actually somewhat common for people to get lost in those relationships and to feel, as I think Nancy is portrayed here, as being overpowered in that relationship. And so she loses touch more and more with sort of the outside world and with the kind of help that she needs, and she becomes lost in this completely over-enmeshed relationship.
So does the parent who does that, what you suggest, is that parent able to build a bridge to the son or daughter who doesn't want help? Does that help them get them help?
In fact, what often happens is...
That's not the purpose of it.
Well, the intense relationship that can often happen between a parent and an ill child, any kind of an illness, can sometimes become very impenetrable. And it becomes more about protecting the child from the ravages of the world than it does about getting that child help. There's a sense that I am helping, but in fact, you're excluding the world of help in order to create your own, as they call it in the article, prosthetic world of protection and help. And I think that that's at least the picture that's made here. But one of the things I do want to say, and I worry about this article a little bit, is it's a little bit hearkening back to some bad old days in the past when we used to blame mental illness on parents. There was this old-fashioned idea called the schizophrenogenic mother. You know, the way you mothered your kid would make him schizophrenic. And that's just not so. We've really seen that parenting, you know, with very rare exceptions, is really not the cause of major psychiatric disorders. But once major disorders begin, like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder and autism and so forth, then parenting becomes particularly important, in terms of getting ongoing help, being able to manage the case going forward, being able to avail yourself of state-of-the-art treatments, being able to work with advisors and supporters to be able to keep set limits and keep boundaries and not go down the rabbit hole, which at least from this description, it sounds like Nancy Lanza may well have.
I was struck by Peter Lanza's description of his son Adam when he was small as a weird little kid. Remember that phrase?
Yes.
Well, I thought it was completely harmless. I think, you know, you can have a little kid who's just slightly weird. You wouldn't necessarily think he's schizophrenic.
Right.
And what about childhood, say, versus adolescence in terms of detecting and seeing problems?
Well, you know, eccentricities and irregularities in kids do not necessarily go on to become full-blown mental illnesses. And matter of fact, it's not necessarily a good predictor. Some of them do. Most of them don't. Most people who do have full-blown illnesses when they're adolescents or adults, when you look back, actually don't have childhood irregularities. So the ability to prognosticate from that, so it's not like anybody should have seen it coming back when he was just an eccentric and idiosyncratic little child. And I think that's a very important point to make. People shouldn't worry if they see their kids as a little bit different or weird or irregular. It does not necessarily mean they're doomed to have a mental illness at all, let alone a heinous development like this.
Thank you for that, Dr. Comrade. We have time for one more call, which harkens back to the earlier subject of Obamacare and mental health services. Marie's been holding to ask you a question. Go right ahead, Marie. Our time is short, but please ask your question.
No, great. Thank you. I'm a registered nurse, and I do understand that there's a documented shortage of providers who manage mental health issues in all areas of the continuum. As the medical providers, the psychiatrists decrease and the population continues to increase, how do you envision registered nurses, specifically APRNs, assisting to fill this gap in care, in mental illness care?
Yeah, I think that that's a very good question. And the way they've, you know, been instrumental in filling the gap in primary care as well. I think that nursing involvement with nursing sophistication is going to be absolutely critical, both for therapy as well as to possibly be involved in supporting the administration of medication. You know, they can give sophisticated feedback to a doc that may be managing a large panel of patients with, say, nurses being the primary providers of those patients, and can possibly work in a somewhat more medically sophisticated way about at least the medication management portion than, say, perhaps non-medical mental health professionals like social workers and psychologists.
I want to mention a couple of things. Dr. Comrade's thoughts and comments about the Peter Lanza profile in The New Yorker can be found on the WYPR webpage, also a link to it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, along with information about Dr. Comrade's book, You Need Help, A Step-by-Step Plan to Convince a Loved One to Get Counseling. And also, you mentioned earlier the phone number. Quickly, you mentioned a phone number. We're going to post this phone number. This is for folks who get involved in the system and feel like they're not seeing the parity that the Affordable Care Act is supposed to present for mental health services. So we'll provide that information as well.
Yeah. And you should complain, because it's the squeaky wheel that's going to get the oil.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Comrade. I really appreciate you being here. Mark Comrade is a psychiatrist on the clinical and teaching staffs of Sheppard Pratt Hospital and Johns Hopkins Hospital, and he joins us from time to time here on Midday. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And thank you, folks, for tuning into our first hour. We get a short break here for lunch, brought to us today by The Veranda, located in Hamden on 36th Street, serving home-style Indian food, specializing in flatbreads and chaat. The Veranda now opens 7 days a week for lunch, 11:30 to 4 p.m. Please stay tuned for the news and the second hour of Midday.